Hi, this is Daphne, and welcome to the Creativity Habit Podcast, conversations about art, creativity, and courage with artists, creatives, and makers. My guest today started out as a semi-professional graphic designer at just 14 years old. He then went on to art school, where he abandoned graphic design halfway through in order to study an art form he wouldn't be able to learn on his own, which was printmaking. Today, he is a world-renowned woodcut printmaker, specializing in wood engraving and the traditional Japanese art form, Mokuhanga. He has been invited to speak and teach at the International Mokuhanga Conference in Japan, as well as other institutions around the country. His work appears online, in galleries throughout the United States, and in permanent collections, such as the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History, Savannah College of Art and Design, and Vanderbilt University Heard Library, as well as being the feature of a newly released documentary called Storyprint. His prints are meticulous works of beauty, full of vibrant color, play, and story, each one pulling you inside of a different world of magic and imagination. His name is Andy Farkas, and you can find him over at fablewood.com. In this interview, we talk about the necessity of solitude and how to find stillness in the busiest of lives, the seven stages of the creative process, the most important questions to ask after every creative project, and how to know if your art is worth making. May you enjoy this conversation, and may it inspire you to make your thing and change your world. Welcome, Andy, to the Creativity Habit Podcast. I'm really happy to have you here today.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks.
Yeah. So the way I like to start my interviews is by going back to your creativity story. And by that, I mean going back to your childhood and just how creativity showed up for you as a kid.
Oh, that's a good question. I've always been one to be outside in nature. I guess most kids are, but parents let me be outside by myself a lot and kind of explore off and about, gave me a relatively long leash. You know, a lot of my creativity comes from immersing myself in the world, you know, and then it was just kind of a natural outlet. I drew a lot as a child, a lot of cartoons when I was younger. I remember being in elementary school and we were all supposed to pick a profession to be, and I picked a cartoonist, and there wasn't like a book on being a cartoonist like there was for lots of other things like doctors and things. So they made me pick another one. That's anecdotal, really. The best thing was that my parents, you know, let me do my thing. As I grew older, my dad was a graphic designer. So when I was a teenager, he asked me to do some illustration work. I started doing some of that. So actually at a relatively young age, I got some experience doing art, you say, semi-professionally, which was exciting for a young kid, you know, to have stuff that people are looking at. And that was really exciting. And so I've always had an outlet for it. And I guess I've always been encouraged at it.
You talked about being in nature, that a lot of your creativity comes from being connected to the world. And you talked in a paper that you wrote for a conference, you said, how we spend our time away from the practice of art making vitally affects our time as we create. For without time spent away from creative activities, how can we hope to progress with anything more than that which exists within our own mind? I was thinking of going into this later, but since you just touched on that now, can you talk more about this idea of creativity coming from being more out in the world and connecting with the world?
Yeah. You know, sometimes I go out into nature to try and find something to draw or whatever. And sometimes I go out into nature to just be. And I guess the difference there is when I go out to nature to draw, say most of the time what arises is simply practice. You know, I'm finding these beautiful things that I love and I'm drawing them. And so really by drawing them, I'm bringing them into myself. You can also bring things into yourself by observing, by, you know, touching and listening and all sorts of ways. And by bringing that outside inside, you know, you create that connection. These things happen every day, all the time. I deal with natural substances. You know, when I do my carving, it's, you know, I carve into wood and I have plants in my home and I make bread So I'm touching and I'm feeling and I just want people to understand it can happen anytime, any place. It's really just a matter of being open to letting things in. The idea of just being out in nature without any predetermined agenda, just freeing and just kind of like lets you empty out. When you empty out, that's when you have space for things to come in. That's, I think, the important part of like the inspiration or the real impetus behind a creative process is allowing that open space for things to come in and then letting them come in.
Okay, so there are so many points that you mentioned that I want to touch on. So I'm going to have to...
Yeah, to me it just seemed like a whole ramble.
No, it was great. There were so many different pieces and I've made notes so I can come back to them. I want to start before we come back to a lot of them, we're going to talk briefly about the type of art you do so that people listening can say, oh, okay, this is what Andy does. I just want to reiterate one thing though before we go into that, which is I loved this point you made about when you're drawing or making bread or whatever it is you're doing, that you're bringing something from outside into yourself. And in so doing, it's like the idea of who you are just keeps expanding as you bring more and more into you. I just thought that was a beautiful image. I love the way you described that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thanks.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about the type of art that you do now.
Primarily, I'm a woodcut printmaker. So I make images and I carve them out of wood, and they're relief images, meaning that everything I want to print or everything that I want the image to be is left alone and ends up being raised. And everything that is not part of the image that I don't want to print, I will carve away with a knife and chisel. And once the image is carved onto a block, then I'll print it. Right now, I work in two relief methods. One is this traditional Japanese style of mokuhanga printing, which is a water-based printmaking technique where you brush water-based pigment onto a wood block and you print that directly onto the paper. The other method that I currently use now is wood engraving. So the wood engraving is a different process, uses similar tools, but essentially effect is the same. You're carving away what you don't want to print. You're leaving raised what you do want to print.
How did you come to this particular type, going from cartoonist to more graphic design type to this, an illustration? How did they flow one to the other?
Well, I guess the transition really happened when I went to school. I got a degree in art, and when I was deciding on what major within the art department to go into, because I knew I wanted to be an artist, and originally I thought I was going to be a graphic designer. So I went into that initially, and halfway into that program, I decided that that wasn't really for me, and that if I got out of school, that that was something that could, you know, make that happen on my own if I wanted to. So in school, I decided to make sure I learned something that I wouldn't necessarily have been able to teach myself on my own, which ended up being printmaking. Since it was most akin to drawing, I liked the idea of making multiple copies of things. It would be more affordable and more accessible to more people. That's how I ended up making prints. In school, I didn't do a lot of relief printmaking. I did a lot of etching and lithography. So in etching, you use a lot of acids. And I did do some of that when I got out of school, but they're toxic substances. You know, I just wanted to kind of get away from that. So I made another transition. Also, the thing that helped determine going into relief printmaking was the fact that I had very little space. My wife and I lived in a small 600-square-foot house with five animals for 5 years. That's when I made the transition from doing etching to relief woodcut printmaking. And I started with engraving. Engravings are generally small, and I didn't need a lot to do it. So I had these little blocks, and I had these little tools, so I could just make these little prints. And that worked out really well for a while. And then as far as the mokuhanga process, I was working on a book project, because I also write books. But I was working on a project that I had written about a river. I love the works of traditional Japanese printmaking artists like Hokusai and some others. And so I decided to learn that process. Since I had some relief printmaking experience, I jumped in and found that I loved it. Now I work in those two mediums. That's how I got there.
Excellent. And how you got there was its own creative process, both adding and subtracting of I want something that isn't toxic, and I want something
right.
that can fit into a small space and is with a medium that you enjoy working with. So I think it's an important piece to point out insofar as a lot of us, when we start on the path, think we need to know exactly the type of quote-unquote artist that we are or the type of art we want to make, and that it really is this evolutionary process that is just step-by-step figuring out.
It's very true, you know, and even now with the Mokuhanga, I make more of the Mokuhanga prints because it doesn't require a press. I can literally do everything at my small drawing table, so I no longer need to have access to a big press in order to print them. I also will mention anecdotally, too, that a few years back, I suffered a repetitive stress injury on my carving hand from all of the wood engraving carving that I had done. I was unable to draw for probably about 2 or 3 months and unable to carve for about 12 to 16 months. You know, during that time, especially right after that happened, you know, as an artist that's been working in a medium, you wonder like, oh, am I going to be able to ever do this again? You know, that kind of, again, another shift. And the best part of that experience was coming to a place where it was going to be okay with me not to be making prints and art again. To come to that place and then return from it was a really enlightening experience.
And happened because you were paying attention. Well, you couldn't make the work you were doing. You couldn't continue because you were in pain. You had injured yourself. And so it's that same thing. It's working with whatever is happening and saying, okay, now what? Now what does this move into? Now what will this evolve into?
Yeah.
Which brings us in some ways to the creative process. And there's a documentary that's out about you called Storyline. And in Storyline, you talk about...
A story print,
you talk about the creative process. And one thing that you say in particular about it is that it's like a spiral. You see, spirals are how things grow. For me, the creative process begins in a place of gathering. So what does that mean, to begin in a place of gathering?
When you find yourself, you know, out in the world away from the actual art of creating, where you're aware of your surroundings and you're bringing those things in, you know, you're making yourself a part of the world around you by your actions. So that's what I mean by gathering. You know, it happens through observation and touch and feel and listening. That can take place in lots of different places. To have that place of gathering be an effective place of gathering, there needs to be a measure of stillness there so that you're able to let things come in. As far as the creative process being a spiral, I used to think of it that the creative process was more like a cycle, and it is like a cycle. It's like there's the gathering, and then there's the impetus, then there's the tending of the idea, then there's the creation of the idea, and then there's like finishing of the project, and then there's the kind of letting it go out into the world. But then there's one part of the cycle that makes it a spiral and not simply a cycle, and that would be at the end of this process, there's a point in time where you finished a piece of artwork and you take it in and you reflect on it and think about it or meditate on it or whatever it is you want to do about it, in hopes that the next go round something more comes. If you don't take that reflective step, that step where you reflect on what you've done, you go around in the same circle. But if you reflect, then the circle gets bigger. As the circles get bigger, you know, it's like a spiral. And that's how things grow.
When you say you reflect on it in the hopes that the next time around something more comes, say a little more about what you mean by that.
Part of the whole process of living is the betterment of the self. You're trying to better yourself, or not necessarily better yourself, but to make yourself more true or more in line with the world. And when you are in line with what's going on and with your own self, and you're comfortable and you're confident, less bothers you, and I don't know, it feels like you exist better.
Yeah.
I know I do. You know, when more people exist better, then there's more harmony. The world is just a big world and we all live in it.
When you take the time at the end of a piece to reflect, what I hear you saying then is, by reflecting, you are learning from it in a way that helps you show up more in alignment with who you are, or like.
Right. No, I know what you're saying. So there's a couple of things that I do when I reflect on a piece of artwork. one of the things that I do, and I guess the easiest place to start would be, you know, I reflect on the practical aspects, because we live in this tangible world, and I've made a tangible something. And so one of the first things I think about is like, what did I do well in this piece of our work, and what could I do better? Where do I see ways that I could work differently that are going to make my body feel better? What are ways that I can work differently that I'm going to make fewer mistakes, or that the finished piece is going to look nicer? Or maybe there's some things that I did during the process that I liked, but that I wanted to try something new because of something that I tried on a particular piece. Those are all practical ways of reflecting on a piece of work and the process and how you're going about it. Again, that happens with everything. I'll go back to bread real quick. You know, bread is a fickle thing to work with too, but you know, it's the same kind of thing. At the end of a couple loaves of bread, I think, oh, some things didn't work. Maybe I'll try some different timing, or some different flour, or a different amount of starter, or whatever it is you're doing. So the other aspect of that reflection kind of gets into what you were talking about, the nuts and bolts of who you are. So not just necessarily how you're connected to the world, but, you know, everybody's different. Everybody fills a certain space. And so being true to yourself is really important. And so you look at what you're doing and you think about, you know, am I happy with what I'm doing? Is what just came out of me, is it applicable to my life? Is it something that speaks to me? Or do I need to make a change with the kind of work that I'm making, you know, whether in medium or subject matter or size or shape or whatever it is? And so some of that for me is like that connection with my world around me. When I make work, I need to be able to see myself in it. I need to be able to get something out of it so that I can move forward in some manner. I'm not necessarily looking for something profound, but I am looking for little nuggets to grow on. And if I don't find that when I'm done with a piece of artwork, then that's not necessarily a failure, but to me, it's not as successful.
One part of the creative process that you're describing that I keep hearing is this almost motion of putting the brakes on the process, on life, mm-hmm. on all of it, which is something in our culture we mm-hmm. rarely do. Art is almost this revolutionary, or it is. It's a revolutionary act, because it's saying, in the midst of all of this, in the midst of all the goal orientation, in the midst of always moving forward, in the midst of all the busyness, to really create requires both, as you mentioned, the stillness, the being attentive to what's around you, and then at the end, this period of reflection. So that slowing down and stopping is an essential piece to the creation.
Yeah, I mean, it's really essential to every activity that we do. If you're going to do any type of activity, regardless of whether it's creative, if you want to be really successful at it, you need to take the time to prepare. And that's not always reading about it or researching something so that you feel like you're mentally prepared. It's more than that. It's being spiritually prepared. That's where that stillness comes in. You're practicing your intuition. As people, I think we know more than we think we know if we give ourselves the opportunity to observe what's around us. It's there. We just see it. And if you're still enough, you can see what's going on. If if you're quiet enough, you can hear it.
So talk to me about how you create that in your life, because I know that you're a father of three young girls, and you're married, you have a job, you're making your art. Where does stillness come into that? Because one of the biggest things that I will hear from people who want to make something is, I'm too busy, I don't have the time.
Right. That's a difficult thing to overcome. But I will say the simple answer is like the answer that nobody likes to hear is, well, you know, I make that time. Part of it is you make the time. And at some level, you do need to make some time. But just to give everybody encouragement, that's not all there is to it. Like you said, I'm a father three little girls, and you know, I'm married and I have lots of responsibilities in addition to the artwork that I create. And so stillness is not necessarily going to a quiet space and sitting and being still. I'll relate this to something else as an example. So I practice Tai Chi, and Tai Chi is a good practice for me, and I think would probably be a good practice for a lot of people. And one of the reasons I think it's a good practice, is that it lets you practice stillness in your movement. You start to understand that you don't have to be physically still to be still. I know it seems maybe counterintuitive, but really there's a stillness of your mind, and there's a stillness of your spirit that can come, and that it's almost more important than the stillness of your body. The stillness of your body helps, but people can sit and try and meditate, and their minds just go and go and go and go, including mine sometimes. So that's why I say that, because I speak from experience there. The more you practice stillness, and really it just comes from intent and strength of mind. It's a practice that you can do at any time. You can do it while you're washing the dishes, or, like I said, making bread, or even changing a diaper. When I'm just trying to get this diaper on so that I can go off and do something else, that is not being still. But when I'm present in the moment and I'm letting things come as they come, just recognizing my time with my girl, doing something that she needs done, it becomes a quieter time. Even if she's screaming, I'm present, I'm mindful of my actions, I'm not thinking of the next thing, I'm not thinking of the past thing. Then what has the potential of coming are all sorts of things. Like even right now, as I'm talking about this, you know, I think about how that relates to everything else in our world. And, you know, I think about the animals that you care for and a growing tree and how all these things that could maybe influence or work their way into a piece of artwork that I might create. So that's really what I mean by stillness. I do think that having a time set aside, a quiet time to set aside and just be still. I mean, even if you can't meditate or if you don't know how or intimidated by it, just sitting quietly with no intent to do anything else. Having a little space like that to do that in a day is really helpful. You know, making tea is like that for me as well, in addition to Tai Chi. It's a moment during the day where I can stop the busyness of what I'm doing and I can focus on something that requires some focus, that requires me to be in that space. Art does the same thing. And so when I'm creating a piece of artwork, to me, that is a stillness for me. When I make a piece of art, I'm not just trying to get it done. That might be one of the reasons I'm slow, but I'm not approaching a piece of artwork to get it done. I'm approaching a piece of artwork because it's important to me.
Yes. So first I would say that you don't, in reference to what you were talking about with finding the stillness, it doesn't even have to be quiet, because I often find when I'm doing interviews, I get very still, in the sense that I have to be really present. If I start thinking about anything for a sec, I've missed what you've said, and then I can't, I've lost the train of thought, and I don't do a good job as an interviewer. So even here in the midst of a conversation, there can be a lot of stillness and just having to be focused on what it is that's right in front of me, or, you know, right in front of somebody.
Yeah, absolutely.
Earlier, you talked about in creating a piece of work, how when you reflect back on it, you'll ask yourself questions and you'll look at, was I true to myself? I want to explore this a little bit more, because the creative voice is another thing that will come up a lot. How do I find my voice? How do I find my writer's voice? How do I find my artistic voice? And in some sense, I feel like this is a way that you get closer and closer to your voice. Is that true?
It's absolutely true. It's the only way. Boy, it's like anything else. And for those, I mean, you have kids, so you know too, but you know, kids are a good example. You see how they learn. They learn first by imitation. They try on things that other kids try on, you know, whether it's language or clothes or anything else. It's the same way in art school, traditionally, and even now, you know, you copy other artists. You see how they do something, you like it, so you try what they're doing. But at a certain point, you feel like you're confident enough to feel like you have something that you want to say on your own, or, you know, whether it's visually or otherwise. And so you start playing with these other ideas. You start mixing things up, and that's all part of that reflection process. It's really a natural part of making artwork. You make something, and then my 5-year-old, I just made this drawing. It stinks, crumple, throw it away, let's do another one. You know, even in that moment where like, oh, this stinks, that's, you know, she at least looked at it and reflected. Let's try and make that better. But as far as finding yourself or your true voice, I mean, really, it's just a matter of being true to yourself. I'll give an example. And this was helpful to me. So, you know, I look back on my life and how things have fallen into place, and or just different opportunities have arisen that have allowed me to explore and to find out certain things. One of those instances was after I got out of school, I started doing metal etchings. And, you know, a lot of the work I did was reminiscent of a lot of traditional figurative works. My prints look like Rembrandt or Whistler, which are two artists I greatly admire. And a lot of people really like them. I'm a good draftsman. I know how to draw, and I functionally learned how to create a print, and I knew how to put things together to design a nice image. So I was making nice prints, but they weren't really doing it for me, even though people did like them. And so when I moved to Pennsylvania with my wife, or my wife was going to graduate school at the time, I had a friend who was a poet approach me about doing a cover for a poetry journal. He decided he wanted to do a letterpressed poetry journal, and he thought it'd be really neat to do an old-time wood engraving, and he asked me to do it. He knew I did metal engraving, and I was a printmaker. I was familiar with those processes, and he liked my artwork. I asked him what he wanted for the cover, and he said, just do whatever you want. Whatever you want. Doesn't matter. I could have just taken that and done another piece similar to what I had done in the past, but I decided to take his advice and just make something that I wanted to make. And so I ended up making this image of a bear who had launched himself off of this cliff, and he had attached this some sort of parachute device, and the wind was lifting him up over this canyon, and he had been wearing this crown, and the crown fell off of his head. This was the image that I did, and I loved it. I loved every minute of making that image. And not only that, but when it was done, he loved it. And everyone who saw it just loved it. It resonated. It resonated with me, and it started resonating with other people. So I decided to make work that resonated with me from now on. I'm lucky. You know, I hit on something, and then I was able to put my finger on it. Sometimes it's difficult for people to put their finger on it. They don't hit it, but you know, the more you try, the better chance you have.
It's beautiful. That's a beautiful story. The thing I think that can help with that is what I heard from this story was basically show up as you as much as possible. And then people love that because we all want to see the uniqueness of the person in front of us. Like that's the most interesting piece of a human being is seeing as much of what makes them, as opposed to like everybody else. And that's what you did with this piece of art, is that you made something that was you. You loved making it, you loved how it looked at the end, and then people loved how it looked. They got to receive not just the art, but they got to receive you when they looked at that. And that's part of what's probably spoke to them.
Yeah, I mean, that may be. I mean, let me take a quick step back and just kind of like reiterate a point that you mentioned. Sincerity is a really important aspect of life. When you do something with sincerity, it has a tendency to shine, no matter what it is. If you're sincere about something, you can feel good about it. If you're not feeling good about something, that's kind of a red flag or 100% behind it. I'd also say the way I love to think about it is that, and this kind of brings me full circle, is that because I'm connecting to like the world around me, that the people that respond to it aren't necessarily connecting with me, but they're also connecting with everything that I'm connecting with. Does that make sense?
Yeah. At least I think it does. So they're connecting with everything that you're connecting with because they're getting to see that through your art. Is that?
Yeah. In other words, because we share experiences, we share things that are more to the core of our being, of our existence. I exist and I experience certain things, and so I make this work. And because I make this work for myself and I'm sincere in making it for myself, that other people will come to it from wherever they are, but they will recognize that we all share these common threads of existence.
Yes. It's similar to certain things that have been taking off recently and not so recently, but like Humans of New York as a good example, where this man says, you know, Brendan says, I'm going to take pictures of people, just regular people on the street, and I'm going to, and then he starts listening to their stories, and then their stories become the piece that people really resonate with, because we get to see the humanity in all of us by seeing the humanity in one person. And we feel even more connected by seeing that. I don't know if I'm taking this on a little bit of a different path, but it's just...
No, actually, I think that's it's a very good path, because the microcosm is definitely an example of the macrocosm. And this is another thing to hopefully give encouragement to people who don't feel like they can get out into nature very often or do this or that, because small bits like the houseplant or the making of bread, I mean, they're not small things. They may seem like small things, but they're not small things. That's just the same. They're just the same as all these other things. There's no reason that a rock that's sitting on the side of your porch is any different than being out in the middle of a forest and seeing a rock. You know,
yes.
Remove that from the equation, and all of a sudden you can start seeing everything a little bit differently. The other thing I loved about what you just said was that people resonated with the stories that went with the image. I love that too, because I do feel like it's really, really strong connecting image with a story in the right way. The writings and the stories of those people, they would probably still be impactful, but they're not as impactful without the image. And the image isn't as impactful without the story. It's a good example, and it's what I strive for in my work too, but it's a really good example of how those two media work together to like create a complete, more of a complete picture that you can kind of dive into.
Yes, and it's true. That is a huge part of your work. We only have a little bit of time left, so I want to ask just a few more questions here, and it is switching gears a little bit, but in the talk that you gave on your work, you wrote a paper for a talk that you gave. You start with a story that's about a little boy who stumbles upon a man who's painting, and the boy watches the man paint, and then he watches as this man, frustrated with what he's making, crumples it up, you know, throws it to the ground and walks away, leaving not just his painting, but his art supplies, everything. He's giving up on art. And the boy sees this and takes the painting and then spends the next many years of his life trying to paint as good as this one painting is that he found. And eventually feels that he never actually reaches that. And grows in the same way as the man in the beginning, grows frustrated with his art, grows frustrated with his own work, and abandons painting and goes into something else. So the question that I have around this is one of the biggest challenges in the making of art, is comparing our work to that of another and saying, it's just not good enough. I can't do it. I'm giving up. How do we work with that? And how do we not fall into that trap of comparison so that we show up as who we are and let that be not only enough, but perfect in its own way?
Well, you didn't finish the story.
I know I didn't. I know.
The story continues. You know, he goes through a number of different life cycles. And then at the very end of his life, he finds the courage to make another piece of artwork. And somebody sees it and appreciates it. And he relates to this person how he used to be an artist and, you know, he just left all of his things behind. But the person that came and found his artwork and who appreciated it ultimately goes off and finds the remainder of his old artwork. And he loves it all. He takes it and he shows it all in the museum. And part of that was that he asked the man to borrow that piece of artwork so that he could show it. And so he let him borrow it. And, you know, ultimately that man brings him back that piece of artwork. And he said it was well received. He didn't tell the man all about the finding the other artwork or how, you know, showing all the rest of the artwork. For me, that story, I kind of leave that the end of the story kind of open, because to me, to put a real close on that story is not the point of the story. So to me, the point of the story is this, and that is, during the time that you're making the artwork and you're frustrated, does not mean that you're a failure. It does not mean that your artwork is bad. And it does not mean that you're not being true to yourself. The man at the beginning of the story who threw his artwork on the ground inspired another artist because the artwork that he threw on the ground wasn't good enough to his standards. But it was more than good enough to inspire another artist to make more artwork. So the first artist, the feeling of being frustration is just a feeling. And then the second artist who was inspired, who worked for so many years to try and be as good as that first artist and who never felt like he was, those are his feelings. But what it doesn't take into account was that he was who he was. He made the artwork that he was going to make. Just because he felt frustrated at the end of his life or at the end of his art making or even during his art making doesn't mean that he wasn't true to the art and that his artwork wasn't good. Because all that artwork that he made, even though it didn't meet his own internal standards, also, just like the first artist, it met with much success in later time by different people. So I guess the point is that being frustrated is just a state of mind. If you think you're bad, then you're bad. If you think you're good, then you're good. And so for the artist, it's just a matter of making the work. Because that artist in that story was being true to himself.
I love that. That's beautiful. I'm going to ask where people can find you. And then there's two more things. One is something I like to do at the end of the interview. And then one is a question I have for you to end the interview. Okay. So first of all, where can people find you?
I have a website, fablewood.com. And you can see my artwork there. And you can contact me through that website. There's my email on there too. I guess I'm on Instagram too. I don't check that all the time, but I post there occasionally. And also the documentary that you just mentioned, it just released out online, so you can view that on my website as well. And also it's on Vimeo. I'm not sure what the web address is there, but if you can see it on my website, so that wouldn't be a problem.
Great. Okay. So then the thing that I like to do before asking the final question is just to pause for a minute to appreciate your contribution both to the interview and to the world, and just say how much or how grateful I am for your willingness and commitment to showing up as who you are, and that striving, even though that's sometimes perceived as a negative word, but in a positive sense, this striving to be who you are as much as is possible. So be in alignment with who you are while here on the planet in this form. And the taking the time and the presence to slow down, to reflect, and to think about things so that what you then create is even more beautiful the next time, because your art is really beautiful. So I just want to appreciate you for that.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. And then the last question is, and you spoke to this actually in the telling of the story, but if you have anything else to add, why it's important for people who have something to make, which I believe is everybody, but for people who have something to make, despite the fears, the doubts, the insecurities, all that stuff, to make it, why this world needs people to make their thing.
Everybody needs to make their thing because being creative is part of who we are as people. We are creative beings. We have the capacity to create. And when we create, it makes us more of who we are. It's part of our nature. It's part of who we are. Just like wolves howl at the moon. We create. That's what people do. If you don't take the time to create, then you're missing a part of your existence.
Thank you. That's great. Thanks, Andy.
Thank you.